So I just want to describe a little bit the history of Buddhist monasticism, and then go into my own experience, because it was suggested that people might find it rather interesting to know how somebody who grew up in Southern California wound up with a hairdo like this. So Buddhist monasticism began 2,500 years ago in ancient India at the time of the Buddha. People were organized into communities. At first it was a tradition that was, they were wandering monks and nuns, going from village to village, and then they would just stay put during the monsoon season, the rainy season in Indian summers. And then after that, after the time of the Buddha, then the communities grew more and more stable, and they stopped wandering around so much. And the lineage of nuns' ordination exists from the time of the Buddha. The first nun was his aunt. And so Buddhism spread from India, it spread down to Sri Lanka. The nuns' ordination went down to Sri Lanka, then went from Sri Lanka over to China, and then afterwards Korea and Japan. And then at the a few centuries later, Buddhism went up northwards to Tibet. So there's two levels of, actually three levels of nuns' ordination. And for the highest level, it needs a community of 10 nuns, fully ordained nuns, to give this ordination. But for the lower level, it doesn't need that. So the highest level, this Bhikshuni ordination, it went to Sri Lanka and then China and Korea, but it never went to Tibet because it was too difficult for the women to travel over the Himalaya mountains. So only the first level of ordination went to Tibet. Years later, the Bhikshuni, the full ordination, died out in Sri Lanka. There were, some repression of Buddhism at that time, and so it died out, and only the initial level remained. In Thailand, the women have, the men are fully ordained, the women are in this kind of limbo situation. They're not really lay people, they've taken some vows, but they aren't really even the first level of nuns. So there's a bit of difference in the different Buddhist countries according to what level of vows the nuns have. The full lineage still exists in Korea and in the Chinese tradition, and so there's been a resurgence of interest amongst women of all the different traditions of going there and taking the ordination and then bringing it back to their own tradition. But this is something that has to be done slowly because it involves major shifts of thinking in the traditions that haven't had the full ordination for women for many centuries. And Buddhism, as it went from one country to another, it changed very much. The essence of Buddhism, or the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings, that didn't change. But a lot of the external things changed. And so, for example, when Buddhism was initially begun, the robes were in saffron color. When Buddhism went to China, it was considered very horrifying for anybody but the emperor to wear gold. So they had to change the color. And it was also considered very indecent to show your skin, so they made it with sleeves. So you see the Chinese monks and nuns are dressing in gray sleeves with like trousers. When Buddhism went to Tibet, they didn't have the color to make saffron dye, so they darkened it. Yeah? So you have different aspects of this changing. Another example is when Buddhism first started, like I said, they were initially wanderers, and it was set up for the Sangha, or the monks and nuns. They would go door to door at lunchtime every day, and the lay people would offer them food, and it was set up as a relationship like that so that the people in society who wanted to dedicate their lives fully to spiritual practice wouldn't have to spend time working and farming and cooking and doing business. They could just study and do their spiritual practice, and the other people would support them, and then these people in turn, would teach and would act as an inspiration to the other people. So it was a system set up by the Buddha of mutual help. One side giving more materially, the other side giving spiritually. So as Buddhism went south to Sri Lanka and Thailand like that, they kept up the tradition of going on alms gathering. You know, they would have their big bowl and go from door to door, and then people who wanted to, there was no social pressure, they could make offerings of food. But when Buddhism went to Tibet, it didn't happen like this, because Tibet is a very large country. If you were going to walk into the town every day, it would take you 4 hours, and there's snow and there's wind, and it was just difficult. So you got more communities that people then came and brought things to them, and then the communities began to buy land and be more self-sufficient like that, but still with much support from the laity. So just even in terms of the economic situation of the monks and nuns, it's slightly different in each country that Buddhism has gone to, because it's adapted, external things have adapted to the culture that it's been in. Now, in terms of my own particular involvement with Buddhism, I didn't grow up as a Buddhist. I had a Judeo-Christian upbringing, and I was always asking a lot of questions, you know, why am I here and what's the meaning of life? And because I grew up in the time of the Vietnam War, I was asking, why do we kill people if we want to live in peace? And I grew up, you know, at the time of the race riots, so I was asking, why do we discriminate people on the basis of their body? You know, what does it mean to be a human being? Why can't we live together? And I didn't find a lot of answers forthcoming in the community I grew up in. In fact, often my questions were discouraged. I was told, just go out with your boyfriends and have a good time and don't think so much. Yeah? But somehow that didn't really satisfy me. After I graduated from UCLA, I traveled some and then came back to Los Angeles, and I was working in the LA City Schools, teaching in an innovative school. And one summer vacation, I saw a flyer in a bookstore about meditation. There was a 3-week meditation course taught by 2 Tibetan lamas. A lama is a teacher. So it was summer vacation, I had nothing better to do, I went. And I wasn't really expecting anything. In fact, I didn't really know what to expect. And maybe that's why things became very powerful for me, because this course was set up where we would hear teachings and then we would meditate or contemplate on the teachings that we've heard, thinking about them logically, thinking if they apply to our own lives. And I found that as I did this, pieces began to fall into place, and I began to get little twinklings of answers to some of the questions that I had sat with since childhood. And in addition, Buddhism provided many ways of working with events that happened in our daily life and transforming destructive emotions like jealousy or anger. And so I found that as I practiced these, it really began to influence my life in a very positive way. And so I decided that I wanted to become a nun. This was completely my own choice. There are many people who meet Buddhism and practice and don't decide to get ordained. But I know myself very well, and when I really did a lot of introspection and I saw how deep-rooted was my selfishness, my anger, my clinging, it seemed to me that I really needed a lot of discipline in order to break the old mental and verbal and physical habits. So I thought that taking ordination would give me the framework in which to do this very substantial transformation that I really saw needed desperately to be done. So I took vows in 1977, and I spent many years living in India and Nepal, and then as Buddhism began to spread to the West, my teacher was asked to open centers in other countries. So I spent nearly 2 years living in Italy and 3 years in France, and kept going back to India in between these. And then later, my teacher asked me to go to Hong Kong and then Singapore to actually give teachings and to try and help other people that way. So my life has been, you could say, still wandering like the ancient Buddhist nuns used to do, except we do it in airports now. So what was it that attracted me to Buddhism? Well, there were several things. Like I mentioned before, you know, the psychological aspect, the ability, the techniques to deal with daily life problems. Another thing that really appealed to me, and perhaps it was the thing that first opened my mind to listen to the teachings, was the first thing that the teacher said was, "You don't have to believe anything I say." And I said, "Oh, good." And then I started listening because I didn't have to believe anything. And he really explained how important it was in Buddhism to hear teachings and then check them up, check them logically, check them according to your experience, and then you can practice and have faith in them. Not actually faith, but more confidence, but that comes from your own internal understanding. So I really like that inquisitive approach that Buddhism had, because I had a very scientific upbringing. I like discussion, I like debate, and so I like to have the freedom to ask questions and challenge the things that were said, and I found that was really possible in Buddhism. Also, Buddhism was quite open to scientific investigation, in the sense that you see even now His Holiness the Dalai Lama has many conferences together with Western scientists, and he's really eager to learn about Western scientific position and have the scientists run EEGs and all the different tests on the meditators to see what things happen. So there was this openness to integrate Buddhism with science. They didn't have to be contradictory, so I found that very refreshing. Also, Buddhism explains things in terms of cause and effect, that things don't happen completely out of nowhere by accident, but that everything happens as a result of previous things, and things that we do now influence what happens in the future. This isn't predetermination by any means, but it just means that there's a link between the past and the future, and that things don't exist as isolated events in space. And so when applied to our human existence, it becomes a discussion of rebirth or reincarnation. The fact that our conscious experience now didn't come out of just nowhere, but it's a continuation of the conscious experience that we had prior to this birth. And similarly, our consciousness will continue after our death time. In other words, our body is like a hotel that we live in, and death is simply, you know, checking out of one and checking into another. And so there's no reason to kind of cling on to your hotel room. And you know, that's kind of very nice to know at death time. So I found that the talk of rebirth something to be very stimulating for me. I didn't really believe it at first, but as I began to look logically, as I began to listen to stories, it began to make more and more sense to me. And just even later on, looking at my own experience, you know, and of course Buddhism believes that, you know, genes influence, you know, who we are, and so does the environment. These things are in no way denied. But when I looked at my experience, and why am I a Buddhist nun? Well, genetically, there are no Buddhists in my family tree. Yeah, there's nothing Buddhist about me genetically. Also, in my environment, I grew up in a middle-class community in Southern California. I had very little exposure to Buddhism except in social studies class. So there was no real spirituality or Buddhism in my upbringing. And yet somehow, when I came in contact with the Buddhist teaching, something clicked. And something clicked so strongly that I wanted to really, you know, dedicate my life to this spiritual transformation. So it seems to me that one possible explanation could be that in previous lives there was some familiarity, there was some connection with Buddhism, you know, that was lying dormant in my childhood because externally there was nothing to provoke it, and yet when I finally did meet teachers, some interest came out, much to my own surprise. Because I tell you, if when I was 20 somebody had told me I would be a Buddhist nun, I would have told them they were completely crazy. I had no intention of doing that with my life. Another thing that really sparked my interest in Buddhism was the discussion about the disadvantages of selfishness and self-centeredness, and the actual specific techniques for the development of love and compassion. Because when I grew up, everybody said, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we all loved each other? But I grew up in the middle of the Vietnam War, and I didn't see a whole lot of love, you know, and so I didn't understand how were we supposed to love everybody, because I knew a lot of obnoxious people. But, you know, finally when I met Buddhism, there was this very step-by-step way of really talking about, you know, how to diminish our anger, how to see others as lovable, how to let go of this fear of opening ourselves, this fear of really loving others. There was like a really step-by-step method, so I was very attracted to that. Also, another thing that attracted me was that Buddhism, it existed for 2,500 years. You know, there was a whole tradition behind it of people who practiced and who got results. And in this day of the American spiritual supermarket, where there's so many self-arisen teachers and all sorts of extraordinary paths coming on, I felt like coming in contact with Buddhism was really showing me something that was tried and true for centuries and centuries and centuries. Okay. Practice of meditation was another very appealing thing for me in Buddhism, because again, there were specific techniques for quieting the mind, for going deeper, for getting to know oneself. And that was very appealing. And also in Buddhism, there isn't this split between intellect and feeling, or between intellect and intuition, but rather the Buddhists approach it as one thing helping another. In other words, if you really use your mind in a very sharp and astute way, and you use logic to understand things, it will bring about an inner transformation of your feelings, of your mental states. So the putting together of experience and intellect, instead of dichotomizing them as we so often do in the West, was very appealing, because then two things helped each other rather than conflicted. Now, as a first generation Buddhist nun in the West, there's many challenges, and my quote-unquote upbringing as a Buddhist nun has been rather peculiar. It isn't like that of the Tibetan Buddhist nuns or the Chinese Buddhist nuns, because these people have long-standing traditions. They take ordination, they move into the monastery, they pick up what it means to be a nun by osmosis, by living in the community, they get instruction in their own language, they have the support of the society around them. You know, as a Westerner, kind of everything's completely different, because Western society doesn't understand what in the world people like me are doing. And there isn't a lot of support from the society. We don't have monasteries to move into where we can just automatically move in. And so it's very much a process of, it's a challenging process, and it can sometimes be extremely, extremely difficult. The one advantage I've found is that because I cannot always rely on the energy of other people to guide me along the path, you know, although I certainly do rely on them, but it isn't always present in my environment, it's made me really look much deeper in myself and try and find some spiritual energy there. So in spite of the difficulties, I find that one advantage. Bringing Buddhism to the West is a very big challenge, because we're really working to bring the essence of a religion or a spiritual path from one culture into another culture. And Buddhism in Asia is very mixed with the cultures in Asia, and sometimes it's very hard to figure out what is Buddhism and what is culture. You know, at least when you first join into Tibetan Buddhism, my idea was, well, it's all Buddhism, and I just followed it all. And I remember my first few years as a nun, I was trying to behave like the Tibetan nuns. And the Tibetan nuns, they're very meek, they're very quiet, they would never speak in a group like this. You know, they always take the back seat. Tibet is a very patriarchal society, and the women aren't given you know, in the family and business they have equal rights, but in religion and politics they don't. So the Tibetan nuns were really shy and retiring, very beautiful people. But, and I tried to act like that, be very quiet and very meek. And, you know, I tried like that for a year or two, and then I said, hold on, something's not working, you know, this isn't me. Yeah? I have a Western personality, you know, there's no sense that I try and act like an Asian nun. I'm a Western woman. Yeah? So that was a big thing for me to come to terms with, that spirituality was really an inner transformative thing, not just how you behaved in society, although of course your behavior, you know, is indicative of what's going on inside, but that there wasn't some stereotypical standard brand nun that I had to squeeze myself into becoming. You know, that it was okay to use my personality, but transform all the motivations and deeper things going on inside. And then, in 1986, I went to take Bhikshuni vows in Taiwan, and so there I was living in a Chinese monastery. And again, this brought home to me the question, what is Buddhism and what is culture? Because I had grown up as a Buddhist in the Tibetan culture, and all of a sudden, there I am in a Chinese monastery, and I was wearing Chinese robes, which are very different than ours, and the Chinese are very particular about the way you wear your clothes. You know, Chinese culture, if things are very formal, things are done in exactly a precise way, while the Tibetan culture is much more relaxed about that. And so the nuns were always having to fix my collar and adjust how I was holding my hands, you know, and that just really threw me. I wasn't used to that. And then in the Tibetan monasteries, we used to sit down and do our prayers, and in the Chinese ones, we would stand up, and my legs swelled because I wasn't used to standing hour after hour. I was used to sitting after hour after hour. And there were many changes like that. The language was different, the way of bowing was different, the prayers were different, it was different language. And so this really forced me to ask myself, what is Buddhism? Yeah? And it made me also look at the fact that I'm not a Tibetan, although I've grown up in that tradition. I'm not Chinese, although I grew up somewhat in that tradition. I'm a Westerner. And so I have to bring the essence of this religion into my own cultural context. And that's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge, I can't tell you. Because there's a lot of tradition, there's a lot of accepted habits. And then, of course, there's one's own fear of maybe distorting the essence out of our own ignorance. So it's a slow process, but again, I find it something that's really making me look very deeply at what is a spiritual practice and not just superficially. You know? So it's become quite clear to me that spirituality isn't the clothes, it's not the prayers, it's not the monastery, it's not these things, but that real spirituality, it has something to do with your own heart, your own mind, and how you relate to people, how you relate to yourself. And it's something that we can't put our finger on. It doesn't have color and shape and form, because consciousness, mind, is, you know, without form, and the whole practice is an internal transformation. Okay. Then there's also some other things I see really influencing Buddhism as it comes to the West. One of these being Western idea of democracy. Because in Asia, the Buddhist institutions, and here I'm not talking about the essence of Buddhism, I'm talking about the institution, the external form of it, it's very hierarchical. And in the old monasteries, your opinion isn't listened to unless you're 65 or 70 years old. Yeah? And yet in the West, we run things very much on a democratic basis with much more expression. So I think as Buddhism comes from the East to the West, you know, a lot of the hierarchy will naturally get left behind. I don't think that becoming anarchy is beneficial. You know, certainly we need leaders, we need guidance, But instead of everything in the organization of a monastery being from the top down, I see it actually going back to the way that the Buddha actually set it up in his time, which was as a democracy. Because when the Buddha set up the monastic system, they were voting. The elders in the order would get together and vote. You know, and actually this was abandoned through the centuries in Asia. And I think now in the West, you know, we will revive that. I see also the feminine element, that's not a really a good word, but maybe women's influence, you know, coming more into Buddhism in the West, in the sense that most Asian societies are quite patriarchal, and women, although they have a lot of space to practice, they are usually not public religious figures. Also in the Tibetan tradition, until recently, the nuns didn't get the same education as the monks. And, you know, they are treated differently than the monks. In the Chinese tradition, the women are a lot more active and they teach and they do social work. In the Tibetan tradition, not so. And so I see that as something that's going to change as Buddhism comes to the West. Because I don't think Western society wants the disequilibrium of relationships, you know, among different people of different genders. So I think that men and women will be more equal in Buddhist practice here. Another thing that will change is social involvement, because at the time of the Buddha, the people were not really encouraged to get involved in social issues, in hospitals and education and things like that. They were encouraged more just to do their practice, to meditate, gain realizations, and then on the basis of that come and help society. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama is always encouraging us now to learn from the Christians in terms of Buddhists offering social service and getting involved in social welfare activities. And there's also a very strong movement in Western Buddhists to get involved with ecology and with the peace movement. And so this is a big change from Buddhism in Asia, where it was much more either in the monastery or in the hermitage. Now it's coming much more out into the world. Okay, so that's just a little bit. I mean, there's a whole lot to say. But that's just a little bit about, you know, the history and my experience and about bringing Buddhism to the West.